Okay, well, welcome everyone. Thank you all for coming to listen to our invited guest, Cristina Rivera Garza. She's joining us from San Diego, where she is professor and head of the MFA in the writing program at UC San Diego. She also has a PhD in history from the University of Houston. She's done work on the history of mental illness at the turn of the 20th century in a women's prison, right, La Castañeda. Mm-hmm. She's written scholarship, fiction, essays, many, many things. She has a weekly column, La Mano Oblicua, a blog that you can check out, No Hay Tal Lugar. And I think perhaps she's best known for her novel, Nadie Me Verá Llorar, No One Will See Me Cry, which won the Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz Prize in 2001. She's also won the same prize for La Muerte Me Da. How is that translated? Is it translated?
Death Hits Me.
Death Hits Me, okay. In 2009, I was most impacted by her collection of essays titled Dolerse, Textos de un País Herido from 2011. That is a collection of an assortment of texts on Mexico's ongoing problems with violence and the way the war on drugs, which, as many of you know, has claimed some 60 to 80,000 deaths since 2006, has affected everyday people living in and outside of the affected regions, such as her home state, Tamaulipas. Without further ado, on behalf of the Latin American Studies program, the Department of World Languages, Literatures, and Linguistics, and the Department of English, who are co-sponsoring this event. I'd like to thank very much. I'm going to turn over the floor to Cristina, who's going to do a reading for us, and then open it up to questions and answers. So I'm sure you'll have any questions.
All right. Thank you so much, Victoria. And thank you, everybody, for being here. We've been traveling all morning from... Where was that?
Charlottesville.
Charlottesville, yeah. All the way to West Virginia. Thank you to the Latin American Studies program, to the university, all the agencies that had to do with my invitation. I'm very glad to be here. And this is what I'm going to be doing today. I'm going to read a short story, La Mujer de los Cárpatos, Carpathian Mountain Woman, that appeared in one of my short story books. It's called La Frontera Más Distante, The Outmost Border. That book was published, if I remember well, in 2008. But the short story was translated into English last year. It was published in a magazine called Bomb. So you can actually take a look at it. It's fun. And then after that, I would like to read just at the very end, after the Q&A answers session, I would like to read just a very a section, in fact, a fragment of an essay precisely of that book that you were mentioning at the very end, something that has to do with my basic general ideas about what writing is and what writing, I think, is capable of doing among us. So that's the plan of today. And, of course, after I am done with the reading, I would very much welcome your questions, and I would love to have a conversation with you right here. That's the reason why I'm here. To create dialogue, to participate in a dialogue with you, and to actually, contribute to this that is so important in our society, conversation, like true conversation. Thank you. This short story starts with an epigraph by a poet, Michael Palmer. His poem is titled Sun. It appears in a book titled Codes Appearing. Write this. We have burned their villages. Write this. We have burned all their villages and the people in them. Write this. We have adopted their customs and their manner of dress. I first came here 20 years ago. I answered softly as I pretended not to notice his intense blue gaze. He didn't believe me. That's what I assume, that he didn't believe me. So I went on to tell him that I had arrived on the back of a great donkey with a bit of food and a couple of notebooks. He put a blade of grass between his teeth and said nothing. The hint of a smile between his lips, the sky as blue as his eyes, the wind. And you've been dressing like a man ever since? I remembered how he had taken me violently, a stray longing in each hand, a private fury, his fingers like can openers in my mouth. How long I had gone without seeing an artifact like that. I remembered the smell of his sweat, vaguely carnivorous, and the bitter taste of his cheeks, still bent over the river and still pretending not to see his intense blue gaze. I told him it was better to live alone as a man. He didn't ask me why I said that. He picked up his small leather satchel and started to leave. I counted his steps without turning around to look at him. When he got to number 23, he hesitated. He turned around. "Will you wait for me?" he asked. "Yes," I said, still bent over the river water. I put my hand in the current and pulled out a smooth, round stone. I held it in front of me as if it were a mirror. Then I slipped it into the right-hand pocket of my overalls. I thought I wanted to remember that afternoon. I thought the stone was in place of the stranger. I never knew why I had mentioned that figure 20 years. I also didn't know what it was he'd made me promise to wait for. Before choosing my destiny, I had read about them. A strange book, half history and half legend. A book from a library in the city. I read it immoderately, as I used to do in those days, with the moistened tip of my index finger perpetually poised to turn the page. I forgot to eat. I only stopped occasionally to get a drink of water, but I never actually drank it. As soon as I put the rim of glass to my lips, I would become distracted again. Something urgent called to me from across the room, and I answered that call. Before closing the book, I had already made up my mind. I would leave that place, that kitchen, that library, that city. I could become someone else, one of them. It's difficult to explain why one does the things one does, but everything happened just like it does in books. I left that place, and almost without a plan, I showed up in a small village where they needed men. I put on my new clothes and I committed myself to a life of celibacy. And they, who were so few, bowed their heads when I passed. The stranger showed up in front of my door one day at around noon. He didn't arrive, as I once had, on the back of a donkey, but on the battered seat of a military vehicle. A mud-spattered windshield, 4 thick tires, a torn canvas roof. The letters on the door made no sense to me, but the words he spoke to me did. He asked me for water, and since I didn't move, he opened his canteen and turned it upside down. "Do you understand me?" he repeated with growing exasperation. "I need water." I hadn't seen anyone like him for a long time. His gestures, so childlike, so unnecessary, moved me. He seemed to be afraid of dying. "Where are you from?" I asked him, trying to make him feel less uncomfortable as he stood there in the doorway. Perhaps I was already trying to dissuade him, to distract him. I've never known how to get rid of people. When he gave a start, which he attempted to conceal, I realized that he couldn't see me well. My house, like all mountain houses, was small and dark. Later, he referred to it as the shack. Cool in the summer, warm in the winter, that's why our houses are that way. "So you are a woman," he whispered, in a tone expressing both surprise and amusement. His body was blocking the sun, so I couldn't see him well either. I didn't know how to answer. Then he crossed the threshold, a long and voluminous stride. I was very slow to react. He talked about the war. When he finished gulping down the water, he wiped his mouth with his sleeve and sat down at the table. He asked for food. He asked for more. What's that? He asked when he heard the sound of the bells. A mass? I said as I set a plate with pieces of meat in front of him. Part of a funeral, I murmured later. He ate the same way he had drunk a few minutes earlier, eagerly, voraciously. He ate the food with his hands and he lifted it to his mouth without turning to look at anything else. Then he chewed and swallowed noisily. Then he sucked his fingers clean. When he had his fill, he began to talk. He lit a pipe and talked, without stopping, about the war. The words flowed from his mouth just as the food had entered it a few moments earlier in a deluge. He told about the years of his life. He saw the adolescent he had been, thoughtful and serene. He heard gunshots, the echo of gunshots. He felt thirst. A relentless sun once more wrinkled his skin, blinded his eyes, dried his lips. He swallowed dirt. He desperately craved the taste of salt on his tongue. He allowed himself to be hypnotized by color of fire. He walked for entire nights, climbing hills and descending them again, soaked with urine and with fear. He shot. He closed his eyes and shot many times. You don't know what it is like, he said. And then, without waiting for a reply, he continued. The cold, the filth, the smell of rotting flesh, death. He relived it all again, small body beneath the infinite, maddening sky. You're never more vulnerable than when you are under the sky, he insisted. I offered him some liquor because he seemed to need it. The noise of the bottle touching the wood broke his concentration. He looked at me again. He must have been wondering who I was, what I was doing here, where he actually was, but he didn't ask any questions. He drank the liquor in small sips. After a while, he fell asleep with his head on the table. Every forest always has another forest inside it. The one on the inside is a mythical, enchanted forest found in fairy tales. Living in the outside forest, however, is not easy. Life in the mountains requires effort, discipline, sacrifice. Above all, you need to have good hands. And it never hurts to have a level head on your shoulders, one accustomed to solitude. You need to cut down trees, plant seeds, use frigid water from the rivers. There can be fires. There are bears and eagles and other frightening animals. Sometimes, towards the end of the winter, everything is covered with snow, and you have to walk on the snow, keep moving forward. Sometimes, it's good to be able to recognize the sound of a breaking branch. It's good to walk slowly on dried leaves. Sometimes you take a deep breath. Sometimes everything stops. But more than anything else, there is work in the forest. Lots of work. Fairy tales rarely mention that. And you can do all that by yourself? He asked me later. I told him the truth. No, that I couldn't do all by myself. And my answer seemed to satisfy him. Do the local men come to help you? As often as I help them, I told him defiantly. Or it seemed to me that my tone of voice was defiant. He returned to that topic many times, each time from a different angle, as if he couldn't find the best way to ask what he wanted to ask. Every forest always has another forest inside of it, I murmured when he got out of bed and went to the window and stood there with an attitude of expectation. He stayed that way, very still, for a long time. When he turned around to look at me, I lowered my eyes. Then I covered my shoulders with the blanket. Then I said, "You shouldn't be here." Why does someone grab a pair of notebooks, take a long trip on an empty bus, get off in a distant province, and then travel on the back of a donkey for days and days in order to reach, if they possibly can, the remotest spot imaginable? I don't know. Why does someone choose a forest? I can't answer that either. There is the green, of course, the abundance of greens that are the color green. You have to learn how to see. There is the fresh air and the sky, this sky, blue sky, the solitude of the sky. No one is ever more defenseless than when they know they are alone under the sky. The possibility of remaining silent for hours at a time, days at a time, months at a time. The possibility of forgetting how to write. The possibility of not speaking. There are the extended, callous, dry, brutal hands. They can take up instruments to cut, plant, plow. There is the voice, deep, the echo, also deep. The possibility of saying, we have burned all their villages. We have burned all the villages and the people in them. We have adopted their customs and their way of dress. The laughter inside the church walls during the rites, the slow walking down the aisle, the shaking of hands, the endless bowing of heads. There is the crying of babies being born, a deep echo, another. There is the beginning, the oldest forest, the forest inside the forest, the promise. Listen to this. There is the inescapable fact that we have burned all the villages and the people in them. You can live in the forest without having a theory of the forest. During burials, when I join the funeral procession, and later, when I look inside the coffin at the dead person's face, it's impossible to avoid wondering if it's worth it, if all of this is worth it. The problem, as always, is the children and the old people. The problem, as always, is always the most vulnerable ones. The ones who one fine day abandon the joke and run as fast as they can among the trees, looking for a little light. Sometimes it gets so dark under the trees and so cold. The problem is the ones who lose their minds. You stand there looking at the dark pathways and you wonder about the taste of liquor in the mouth of the man who shoveled dirt over all this. The forest means somewhere beyond. Everything is in flames. There is a moth that flutters in the air. The blade of the instrument has severed the leg. The snow is falling. The nature of snow is to fall. There was snow before. There will be snow afterwards. The forest will never survive. The forest will survive all of that, all of these. In front of the falling house, the illuminated face, an idol. The nature of houses is to fall. The noise of the axe. Soon we will disappear. There is an urgent need to go to the tree. The amputated leg, the trail of blood on the snow, a pair of footprints. I told him I hadn't been in the city for many years. The last one I saw was the one I left behind. Remembering its lights made me blink rapidly. Then I laughed. Show me your hands, he ordered instead of asking. Do you see that? He asked derisively, pointing at my splinters and broken nails. You could never live in the city looking like that. His presumption annoyed me, especially since it was false. It bothered me that he thought I might want to return, that I would be interested in going back to all that, to the city. A woman with red hands. A Carpathian mountain woman. So I turned away from him and continued chopping the firewood into smaller and smaller pieces. I could hear my own breathing, my inhaling and exhaling. I concentrated on my wrist movement. I had to be taut and perfect without vacillating. The shifting of my weight from one leg to the other, the vertical length of my arms, my back. Soon, I settle into a familiar rhythm, my body inside its own choreography, my body inside the forest within. You shouldn't have come back, I whispered, my voice barely audible against the clamor of my agitated breathing. Why did you? People migrate, it's natural, he answered, also with his back turned. While it was happening, while all of this was taking place, I imagined the bodies engulfed in flames. Those visions interrupted my dreams. They interrupted my waking hours as well. They interrupted my theory of the forest. They never learn our language, said some, in an attempt at self-justification, and all of this inside the church. They looked down on our dances, argued others, as the bells rang softly. Did you notice that they never bow their heads? The forest is always expanding. People kept asking the same questions, offering the same justifications. It didn't matter that others spoke of connecting rivers. Any attempt to explain about context, about the vital importance of context for the dissemination of our language, fell on deaf ears. There is something larger. Would we understand ourselves without others who don't understand us? There is something that contains us. These types of questions always provoke the general irritation, widespread grumbling. Within the church, one heard, we burned their villages. It was a deep echo, a very soft voice. We burned the people in them. We adopted their customs, their way of dress. I looked down and found my hands orphaned on my lap. All around me, the word British. Touch this. Civilization is always expanding, and so is barbarism. Between them is the forest. I know. The green, the sky, the snow which falls, the funeral bells, the blood, the footprint. There is a man in the forest who is a woman. There is a woman, a forest. I don't know if they did it for me, but I've always wondered about it. It's not easy to guess other people's intentions. Three more had died, two girls and a boy. There were so few of us. Scarcity leads to strange behavior, the darkness under the trees, being an outsider, inhabiting a foreign realm. Panic is a disease, that's clear. They kept touching the children's foreheads just to make sure the fever could end with them. They tried to decipher their last words. It was a mother who pointed her finger. Panic is a disease, which is a drama. Her crying was a sharp instrument that cut me in two. I had lived among them, in fact, for many years. I had served them well. They had the kind of cautious affection for me that one feels toward someone who, because she arrived late, has lost forever the mystery of the cause. But they didn't view me with suspicion. They bowed their heads when I passed. They interpolated me. They sought my opinion. When I broke a leg, they took care of my farm. One summer, they pulled me out of the well I had fallen into. They gave me 3 lamps, which later became 7, and then 15. Eventually, they became wool and also chunks of meat on pewter plates. We ate together. We swallowed in unison. We weren't intimidated by the gleam of each other's teeth or by the weight of our hands on the wooden table. At this table, we studied their dress and their customs in my notebooks. It was here that we lived through the books and saw the pictures. It was here that we planned the fires. I've spoken their language for as long as I can remember. Don't ask me why someone chooses a forest. I don't have an answer for that. Finally, he said, he had remembered. He said he had seen me a long time ago, months or maybe even years before my departure. He recognized the notebooks, he said, the black covers, their unusual size, the hands that held them firmly. Do you remember that? He asked. Naturally, I answered that I didn't. That didn't make him stop. He said he had been there on the opposite sidewalk, standing in the drizzle, while I waited with the notebooks pressed against my chest for the bus that would take me far away. Now I remember that day perfectly, he assured me. Of course, I shook my head at this. I must have looked at him with enormous eyes because suddenly he burst out in wild laughter. A bird that flies. I started to laugh without knowing exactly why. The kind of laughter which soon turns to hilarity usually leaves me feeling desolate. There is a moment in every story when it's possible to suddenly see what will happen next. I saw it then and there, in the middle of a story invented by a stranger to create a context for a moment that never existed. Inside my desolation, after the laughter. That's why I kept silent. Because of this. Outside, the snow would soon be falling again, silently. Little by little, the footsteps would become audible. The rest would happen in a flurry. The struggle, the bladed instrument in the air, its irrevocable fall, the body parts, the trickle of blood, the footprints. He had said, before his wild fit of laughter, that he was like a person who tells a story only to have the privilege or the power, this, he also said, to include a foreign element into it, something that doesn't quite fit. I saw him then. I used my hands to expose his face. I saw him, absolutely. The last day, the day of the drizzle, it didn't exist, I murmured. It was only then that he kept silent. It's difficult to explain how one can remain still under the snow for so long. Difficult to say, these are my knees, this is your torso, your thigh. These are your fingers. These are the eyes you looked at me with. People migrate, it's natural. It's always difficult to describe what an axe does. Difficult to witness the outstretched finger of the mother, and difficult to hear her howling on the other side of the window, and difficult to break in two very slowly when one understands the verdict. It's difficult to remain still with fists clenched and be a witness to the facts. The branch that rustles, the bird, it's difficult to be under the sky. When I secretly murmured the word Carpathian, I was able to see a forest, a blue sky, a falling snow. I was a little girl then, and that was the truth. Thank you.
Okay,
I was a Carpathian mountain woman. And if you have questions or comments, it would be wonderful to start a conversation. Yes?
Just in general, when you, I'm assuming you write first in Spanish.
Yeah.
Who do you do the translating? Is your editor? And what gets lost in translation?
Thank you for asking that question. I forgot to mention the name of the translator. It's absolutely important to always mention that. This is Alex Ross is the name of the translator, and what happened was something that usually that's what how it's been with me, like someone is reading a story and likes it and knows both languages and then decides to translate that, and that's how Alex did, and then he contacted me and asked me if I wanted this to happen, and I said of course. He had sent me some of the translations he had done before, and they were just fine. And so he did, and that's how we got that published in Bomb magazine. But you know, every time that the translation question arrives, I have to say first that it's thanks to translation that we can actually read a lot of literature. I mean, you've read the Odyssey, you've read Dante, you've read, I don't know, basic major works of literature, and it's thanks, and only thanks to translations that we're able to have that knowledge, right? And having said that, obviously there are things that are lost in translation, but there are many things that are also gained. So I've become very much interested in wind translations myself lately, and I can say that it's just... tremendously difficult and pleasurable at the same time.
is the most, is the closest reading, is like getting at the very structure of someone else's mind, and I very much like that, and I'm very much at peace now with the idea that there is something that is going to be lost. Yes, indeed, always. But a translation is always a version, another person's version of what we have written, and it's just like a reading. It's just a very careful reading that gets published under another people's name, and I think just that's wonderful. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah, I have a question. One of the things that that came through in this reading was the sense of vulnerability,
mm-hmm.
And perhaps that could be productive. I don't know if that's something that was something that I feel has come through in your other writings.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking about precarity, and I don't know if just any comment you might have on.
Yeah, there is something about the practice of writing, I think, in general, regardless of the topic that I'm dealing with when I'm writing, there is something that I'm always trying to reach, and it's precisely that point of vulnerability, which is where I think true sharing can take place. Once, because after all, I'm writing, I try to have control over things that I can't have control over, like my tools, sentences and punctuation signs and, you know, syntax, things like that. But the rest, meaning, belongs to the reader, right? And what could be more vulnerable than that? So I have all these things, they are right there, and I'm trying to create something into which you can dive. Something that you might appropriate for your own life. For me, that is a picture of vulnerability, and writing would be perhaps an opportunity to create that context in which true sharing, true communication, perhaps even some sort of communion can take place. Yes. Okay. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why the Carpathians?
Last time that I read these, it was at UCSD, in fact, I got the same questions. This is a short story that belongs to this book. I said the title, The Outmost Water. And essentially, that's very much the, if there is a storyline at all, that would be the storyline, right? Just to place stories in those almost not legible spaces of life. And obviously you cannot try to take your reader to those places in a very legible way, right? You have, language has to embody the type of experience that you want the reader to have. And so that is just like a general aspect of all these short stories. But in this case, I have been reading a book. I don't remember the name of the author, unfortunately, and I should. It was an essay in a book whose title was Third Gender, Third Sex. And there was a very interesting discussion about these men and women of the Carpathian Mountains. And in fact, this is a true story. I mean, it's historically, it could be historically demonstrated, right? They're women who live and behave as men in the Carpathian Mountains, and they fulfill all the work and functions as males, they live as males. And so I thought that was rather interesting. And since I was dealing with these situations right on the border of what we can understand and not understand at the same time, I thought that this was perfect for the story. So, but I think it sounded good to me, the Carpathian Mountain Woman, very exotic in a way. But also I wanted to
to believe that we go through many Carpathian mountains in our lives. So it's not just the geography, even though in this case it is related to these true stories, but it's more like symbolic geography in many ways, this possibility of going further, going beyond, and what's going to happen once you get there.
Could you talk, it's a very general question, about the process of writing for you? How do you write?
Yeah. Well, there are several aspects to that. In very practical ways, I try to write every day, and that's the first thing that I do in the morning. I use my best energy in the morning after having coffee to do just that. And when I'm not teaching in the morning, that's what I do. And this is just a practical aspect of it. So it has become a habit, a discipline. If I'm traveling, I'm riding in planes, waiting rooms in the airports are really good for that. It's becoming very easy for me to concentrate wherever I am. Hotel rooms are fantastic. You know, things like that. I can write like my weekly column, the newspaper column, in those circumstances, and that's fine. When I'm writing something larger, like a larger project, I need, you know, a different space, things like that. But generally speaking, I'm not that picky. I mean, I have to work. I do work for a living. So I do teach, so I have a lot of responsibilities, and I just make time. And I have a song, too. So. But in another level, I would say that I end up writing about things that I cannot normalize. And it's not only things that I cannot understand. And in fact, I think I write in order for me to perhaps not understand them, but to get close to them, to issues or matters that are relevant for me, just because I cannot, they cannot become normal or apparent or natural for me. And writing is a way of creating circumstances to ask questions about that. Perhaps not providing answers for that at all, but at least to be able to deal with that in a human, in an organic way. And so, and that's the reason why I say that I usually write about things that I don't know. Because if I were to write about things that I know, I wouldn't feel any need to write about them. Right? I mean, it's like it would be just useless and boring. And so that's the reason why writing is so interesting for me, because once I start to get into something, I never know if that something is going to become interesting enough for me, that is to say enigmatic enough, mysterious enough to keep me working around that for months or years, or I don't know if it's going to be an easy matter, and in a matter of weeks, it's going to be resolved. And so usually the things that take me longer to get to that point become novels. And the things that are, you know, when I can get to that point in fewer days, those are just like articles, newspaper articles or something, or letters, right? Once I'm getting there, I'm very, I don't believe in inspiration. I don't believe all these stereotypes about, you know, writers being touched by some divine light or something like that is something that I am very suspicious of. I believe writing is work, and it's a very interesting type of work, and very honorable and wonderful and a privilege in my case. I really enjoy it, but it's something that requires discipline and requires reading, lots of reading, and observation skills. You know, you get used to pay close attention to things. Sometimes it looks, it appears that you are distracted or easily distracted in any case, but it seems to me that's just another way of paying very close attention to the ways around you. And that very close attention is a fundamental part of writing, I think. So there are many things that I'm not aware of when I'm writing, and that's another reason why it is interesting, and I think that's fine, but there are a bunch of things that I think is my duty to be very aware of. And that's when reading the tradition that I'm inscribing myself into is very relevant, reading theory, reading whatever I can get my hands into, that's extremely relevant. So I do teach in a creative writing program, and at times some students have, and I do assign a lot of books in my classes, in workshops, and at times students are not used to that. They believe that they are there just to bring what they have written, and that's it. And some of them have said to me, well, reading takes so much time, it's a waste of time. And I'm like, there is no way you can say that. Reading saves you time. You're not going to be doing over and over again something that is being done over and over again, right? And so you're saving time by reading, you know, these good books. And so, well, it's a long discussion, but so that there is this idea about really getting to know the tools of the trade, and yes, having you know, you have to know how, what kind of sound you want for certain parts of the of the text, and the rhythm that you're dealing with, and how you're going to be pronouncing certain things, and you know what kind of reaction fricative vowel is going to have on the reader, and what kind of reaction this other kind of syntax might or might not have. And so all those things, I think, is my responsibility as a writer to know as well as I can. What I cannot have control on, and I will never attempt to have control on, is about the meaning of what I'm doing. Yeah. So if you, after listening to this story, and I realize listening is way more difficult than actually reading, and if you ask me, well, what is this about? And my true, very true answer would be, that's something that you have to deal with. I mean, that's your responsibility. That's what I'm asking you to tell me what this is about. And over that, I just have no control, will never claim to have control of that. And if you come to me telling me, well, this is about X, Y, and Z, and I had never thought about that, I would say, well, wonderful. I had never thought about that. You have given me my own story. Just you have turned that into something that is yours, and you've given that back to me, and it's a wonderful gift.
I noticed you use a lot of images of body, like body parts, and I was wondering if that fed into like a larger theme of isolation at all.
Oh, that's very interesting. I wanted to. I'm very glad that you mentioned that, because yes, I do believe that writing is something that happens with the whole body. Even though it appears that we're just sitting there and our body is doing nothing, and in fact, it requires a lot of effort. And bringing the body into the text, I think, is one of the major challenges that we have. After all, when you're reading, I don't know if this happens to you, but it does happen to me, the readings that affect me the most are usually those who actually force me to have an experience. It's not only an understanding of something, but with these very humble tools, the ones that I mentioned already, my body is able to experience something that I was not able to experience in any other way. So bringing that humanity, that materiality of the body through the materiality of language into the text, that's something that I'm always aspiring to. One way of doing it, of course, is like mentioning, like in this case, body parts. There are many other strategies, but in this case, it was very relevant. And it was very relevant that the actual action as such were, I didn't want that to be as clearly depicted. It was more like this vision of cut pieces, because to me it had to do with the isolation, but perhaps more specifically with the violence linked to that isolation. And yes, that's of the things that I'm very aware of, which are not many, but that one is something that definitely was very much in my mind as a challenge. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
This might be going out on a limb, but you talked about like how the story kind of gets at the idea of vulnerability and sharing. And do you think that in some way, like this story is kind of a meta narrative.
This one?
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, there are. There is a strategy there, right? I mean, the narrative voice at times is an I that is presenting the facts, and at times there are paragraphs that are coming sort of like out of the blue with a very omniscience, and these perspectives are constantly changing, and some of them are commentaries on some of the things that are not necessarily happening, but perhaps we imagine or thought about, and yeah, it could be a meta-narrative moment of the story. In the actual laying out of the story, there are paragraphs that are completely separated, and there is a lot of use of blank space. And I tried to keep quiet when that blank space was there, but I get anxious and I continue. I should have waited a little bit more. Pauses should have been longer. But that was like an indication for the reader, and in this case for me, although I was a little bit anxious, and I didn't respect my own the structure of the story in that way. And in this story, and I think in several of the stories of this book, I try to play a lot with these sudden changes of perspective. And I wanted, as you know, once you start to read the story, there is a contract being established between reader and writer, and supposedly this contract has to be honored throughout the text. And at times I like to play with the idea that you don't have to. Like, you can change that. And let's see if that works, right? Let's see if the reader wants to continue staying there with you throughout the text. But the idea of this sudden change and this betrayal of the set of rules that are placed at the very beginning is something that is very much part of the story. Yeah. And betrayal being one of the things that I'm dealing with as the anecdote of the text. So it's like the anecdote is embodied also in the structure. Well, this is what I can tell you.
Yes.
Yeah, you talked a little bit about your thinking about, as you're composing, about the sound of words. Can you just say a little bit more about how, as a prose writer, you think about sound?
Yeah.
Working, when you think about it, and what you're sort of playing along with, and what kinds of things
You know, it's very strange, and I'm always speaking critically about the difference that we establish socially between poetry writing and prose writing. And we tend to assume that poets, and this is a definition that I like about poetry, that poets are those who write in the type of language that is investigative language, and that's a Lynn Hagenian's definition of poetry. And prose writers tell stories, right? And so therefore, they don't have to care about all those things that poets do. And they do that because, obviously, since they don't sell books, they have time to care about that. And since these prose writers are writing stories, interesting, engrossing, absorbing stories, they don't have to deal with all that thing, about all the other characteristics of language. So I'm very much against that. And I don't see why prose writers, narrators, could just write without paying attention to our tools. And there are magnificent, marvelous characteristics of the things that we have to deal with. And one of them, one of the many of them, is precisely sound. And it's just a waste not to work closely with this, which is another aspect of the materiality of Vermeer. And I think working with those aspects as closely as we can might bring up, might make possible this process of embodiment that I've been talking about. So if instead of telling, if we want to, write a story that is very light, and it would be better to use words, and sounds that might embody that kind of situation, because what you want to begin with is to share an experience, right? And it's something that is not going to be just working with your mind. It's something that you want, at least that's what I imagine, you want to get to all the structural perception of the person that you are getting close to, which is the reader, right? So I'm very conscious of that when I'm writing. When I'm writing poetry, when I'm writing a novel, or when I'm writing, just generally speaking, I exploring the possibilities of language as such, of grammar, of punctuation, of all these things is part of what makes writing so pleasurable and still very interesting. And to me, that's very much the essence of writing, right? I mean, if we didn't enjoy that, I wouldn't see any sense of doing this. I've said this very often. We tell stories because we are social beings. I mean, telling a story is not what writers do. Telling stories is what we all do. We become social by telling stories. That's how we get our sense of identity, our presence in the world. And I know people that tell stories in ways that writers would only try to do. But there is something that writers do, and that is very specific to the trade, I think. And you have to think about the how. And you have to have that very clearly stated in your practice. And that's something that perhaps the person who is just telling a story, that's not the responsibility of that person, because that's something that we all share and we all do. But the responsibility of the writer, if you want to call yourself a writer, I think, is to think about how we're going to be doing that. And what is my relationship with language in that specific moment, and what I want to achieve. And I say that because I've always thought of writing as a critical practice. I think that writing, what is relevant for me in terms of writing is that it allows me to think that the world can be something else through the use of imagination. And to me, that's just a basic, very, very relevant element of critical thinking, of critical practice. If we are able to think the world can be a different place, we have gained that different world, I think, in the very beginning. And so, if I'm not going to be just pleased by using one or two aspects of this wonderful tool that I have at hand. So I'm going to be paying attention to sound. I'm going to be paying attention to typography. I'm going to pay attention to all the aspects of the page, to all these, what we say when we say the materiality of language, I think. And I think that's the responsibility of poets, of fiction writers, non-fiction writers, whomever wanted to call himself or herself a writer. That's what we do. That's the what distinguishes a trade. Yeah. So, since we're talking about that,
I thought that at the very end, I always forget to do this. I always say that I'm going to do it, and I always forget, but now, thank you for reminding me. This is very slow. Here it is. When I wrote that book, Dolerzi, it's been translated. Jim Hoffer, a translator from LA, is translating this book, and the tentative title in English right now is In Pain, a text from a wounded country. I ended up that book with some phrases, random phrases about writing. And some of them were translated into English by a journalist, by John Gibler. And I would like just to read some of them to you, and so we'll end that conversation with that. Thank you so much for being here. Keep writing. That's the title of the piece. Because we become social through language, my eye that comes from you, your mind that comes from me, our all of you that comes from them. because writing, by being writing, invites one to consider the possibility that the world could be, in fact, different. Because the secret machinery of the text is the imagination. Because here is a banner stretched out that clearly reads, writing's place is also out there, just before your eyes, in the public space of your steps and of the imagination. Because imagination is another name for criticism, which itself is another name for subversion. Because she who writes will never conform. Because writing's essence perhaps consists in nothing more than showing your face, giving your face out, and if necessary, turning the other cheek. Poetry does not impose itself, said Paul Celan. It exposes. But these are small concerns, because to confront is, above all, to confront death. To put yourself in pursuit of the unknown, or its equivalent, the darkness, the dark. In that ethical and aesthetic position of an exhibition that opens and an opening damages, where there arises with singular pressure the certainty that death, regardless of its circumstances, is violence, there, on that path, both the face and poetry go alone. They are alone, and for that reason, too. Because of memory. Because writing teaches us that there is nothing natural. Things are closer than they appear. That, too, writing tells us. Because through that rectangular artifact that is the book, we communicate with our death, and all death are our death. Because the sentence produces the memory wherein forever will live the names of Marco and José Luis Piña Dávila, Ciudad Juárez, Chihuahua, January 30th, 2010. Because the borders of the page are also the limit of the real, because here there is a banner that reads, tell them not to kill me. Because belonging is something I do through you, the sentence. Because there is an abyss at the end of every line into which it is worth the trouble to cast oneself or charge into or disappear into. Thank you so much.